Welcome, listeners, to a new episode of the CASE podcast, a new conversation about software engineering. My guest today, I'm very happy to say, is Steve Vinosky. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
Steve is someone I've admired for a long, long time, and I've known him for a long time. I'm really happy to have him on the show, and our topic today is going to be things a mentor can tell their mentee. Steve, great to have you here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Steve, please introduce yourself first.
Sure. So I work for a company called Arista Networks, but I've got a fairly long history of being in software and even hardware development, I guess about 34 years or so. I started working at Texas Instruments in the mid-80s, working on hardware, working on chips, and they needed someone to write tests for one of the chips that I was working on, and they pointed to me because I was the youngest person on the team. And I didn't know much about software, so I started studying it, and I found that it was pretty cool. So I taught myself a few languages. As I learned more and more, I just kept moving farther away from hardware and more into software. So I went to Apollo Computer in the Boston area in 1987, started using C++, worked in a group that did kind of half hardware, half software for a few years, and then came CORBA, Common Object Request Broker Architecture. There was a team in Apollo, what was then Hewlett-Packard, because in 1989, HP bought Apollo. There was a team that was working on one of the first object request brokers, and I was looking around the company for anybody using C++, and that team was using C++. So I joined that team, not because of CORBA, but because of C++. And I spent quite a bit of time working with CORBA, working on the object management group standards, working in teams and leading teams that developed object request brokers, both for Hewlett-Packard, and then later for Iona Technologies, which was one of the most successful Irish software companies in history. Along the way, I kind of learned a lot more about distributed systems, which is a lifelong thing. You can never learn everything about distributed systems. So that kept me quite busy, still does in some ways. Then, let's see, I kind of was looking at web development technologies as the web got stronger and more powerful and more popular and everything. So looking at the web and found Roy Fielding's thesis on REST, started looking at that and kind of said, wow, that's different than what CORBA preaches. And I could see, you know, a lot of ways that it made a big difference, especially for large scale systems like the web. And so worked with REST for quite a while. In 2006 or so, I found the Erlang programming language and saw that it had a lot of things built into it that we had spent, you know, quite a bit of effort developing in C++. You know, it was already there in Erlang. So I started working with Erlang, worked for a couple companies, including Basho Technologies, the makers of Reoc, who used Erlang. And then about 3.5 years ago, switched gears again, joined Arista Networks. They make network switches and primarily target the data center and cloud technologies, cloud systems. And interesting thing about Arista is they have a mentoring program. Every engineer, doesn't matter how many years of experience they have, when they join, they get a mentor for 3 months, and they're under the guidance of that mentor. And the whole idea there is that we have, you know, as any company does, have our particular engineering process. We have lots of tools that we both, you know, get from outside or develop ourselves. We have processes in place for all kinds of different things that we have to do. And rather than just kind of casting someone into the mix and saying, figure it out, we take the time for a mentor to teach the person where to look, who to talk to, what to do, all that kind of stuff. And it really saves time in the end because, you know, it prevents kind of questionable practices from creeping in, and it just gives that person kind of a comfortable feeling when they're coming to work those initial days. They know who to turn to when they have questions. Anyway, that's who I am.
Great. So when we started out planning for this conversation, I actually wanted to talk about distributed systems for a while, but you said, you've done that. And I said, okay, let's think about other interesting things to talk about. And then I finally noticed that a very interesting thing would be to draw from your experience of 30 plus years and talk to you about this mentoring thing and about the kinds of things that you'd be able to share with somebody who's starting out their career as an engineer. So that's going to be what we're talking about. And maybe we can start with one of the things that people, I think, including myself, fall victim to, or I used to when I was younger a long time ago, which is to be unable to decide what is an overhyped fad and what is something that's really worth learning. So how do you make that decision?
That's a good question and a hard question. I think everyone, you said you did, I certainly did, has experienced the case where you see something that's hyped and you take a look at it and it looks like, hey, this looks great. I'm going to jump on board and, you know, drink the Kool-Aid and this is going to solve all my problems. And as you know, it's not always the case. I guess there are a couple ways to do it. You could be an early adopter or a late adopter, right? If you're an early adopter, you jump in and I think you can get in and start seeing the thing for what it is. You know, you have to grab it and try to make actual use of it. It's kind of like, you know, programming languages. You can look at them. You can say, oh, this looks like this one I know. I kind of know it because of that. But you don't really learn a programming language until you actually use it for real development, not just an example, you know, something that solves an actual problem you have. And that's, I think, can be applied more broadly to, you know, any new technology. If you see something that's hyped and it's saying, you know, people are saying that it's going to solve a particular problem or class of problems, try it, right? Jump in on the early train and give it a try. You might find that, yeah, there's some promise there, but it's got a lot of things missing. And if you're early enough and if you want to put in the time, you might be able to actually influence the technology to go the way you want it to by not only being an adopter, but joining in with the development of the system if that's allowed. So many systems today are open source, so that's generally possible. So that's one way to do it. Of course, being a late adopter means kind of being skeptical and saying, nope, I don't believe a word of it, and I'm not going to even try it until everyone's proven it and it's, you know, it's already solved a number of problems that people have that are like the ones I have, and then I will make use of it. I think what's interesting about those two positions is it kind of goes back to one of my favorite topics, which is the innovator's dilemma and the adoption of technology. So if you look at the work of Clayton Christensen and others who have also worked on this area, you have this kind of bell curve, which is early adopters jumping in and finding that this new technology doesn't quite do what they want, but it's good enough and it's better than what came before. And they kind of coax it along and get it from good enough to better. And then more people see that it's better and they jump in and they kind of help push it even farther and better. And it reaches a peak where kind of the average developer, say, has adopted it, and then it starts to decline somewhat. And that's when the skeptics start to adopt it, and late adopters then pick it up, because by then it's proven itself and it's slowed down its rate of change. Some people fear change, so they tend to wait until the rate of change has slowed. And that's what happens as technology kind of wanes, and then the late adopters pick it up.
I would guess that probably in your youth, you were definitely somebody to adopt things early, right? Which is why you ended up using C++ and Corbr at a time when those were very new things still.
Right? Yeah, I would say that's true.
Has that changed over the course of your career? Have you become more skeptical and more skeptical?
I wouldn't call it skeptical. I think it's more practical. As you know, you tend to see cycles and things, and you see similar things happen over and over again. And so it's almost like being on, you know, Groundhog Day or whatever, where you see a technology and say, oh, that's a lot like this thing that happened a few years ago. And, I'll take a look, but it's probably not any different than that thing. And that thing had the following problems, and that's why I didn't use it. And, you know, so we do have cycles like that. And sure, each iteration does have some improvement, but it's really about, is it good enough to make you want to switch to it? I think also as you have more experience, you do become kind of comfortable with the tools you have and tend to lean on them more. You know, it takes a little bit more to get you to switch. So maybe there is a bit of skepticism involved in that.
Actually, one of the things that I remember is, I don't know which year it was, but we did an interview at a conference. I think it was QCon San Francisco. Mm-hmm. A long time ago, must have been about a decade ago. And that was when you first talked to me about your newfound love of Erlang.
Yeah.
And I actually found that quite amazing that you said something that you said 10 minutes ago, that you noticed that a lot of the things that you had tried to solve or that had taken you a lot of effort to solve using C++ and the Corbr ecosystem were actually a lot easier with Erlang. Was that a hard thing to do? Because it sounded to me like, you know, you were this absolute expert in this Corbr thing, and then you sort of said, well, yeah, maybe I shouldn't have done that.
Is it a hard thing? I don't think it's a hard thing. I think everyone has to look at what they've kind of worked on, and you have to know that it's not going to last forever. And, you know, there's a saying in business that if you really want to succeed, you kind of put yourself out of business before somebody else does. And I think you can apply that to what we work on as well. That, if you want to just get stuck with a technology and ride it out, you could certainly do that. I mean, there's been technologies that have lasted for decades and decades, and people have stuck with them. And, you know, there's a lot of C++ gurus that were C++ gurus back when I started looking at C++ 30 years ago, right? And they're still considered gurus today. So they've rode that along, and they've done well with it. But I think it's usually better to kind of look at things. And like I said earlier, you want to look at new things that come along. Don't shield yourself from them. But, you know, honestly evaluate them. If you're truly an expert in something like Corbr, that means you not only know what it's good at, you know what it's bad at, right? So looking at things like Erlang, looking at what it's got in it, how it works, what are the underlying architectural principles, how do those differ from Corbr or, other languages? I think you have to be able to do that if you're truly an expert. And if something's better, hey, it's better. I mean, there's no point in pretending it's not.
Okay. Okay. So related to that, have you seen people become a victim of vendor marketing? And if so, what's your advice against that?
Yeah, I mean, we've all seen that, I think. That's a tough one. Vendor marketing, you know, can certainly oversell things. I always wonder what the programming language world would be like today if Sun hadn't massively pushed Java 20 years ago, 25 years ago, whatever it was. I think it would be a lot different. You know, I think for a long time, Java kind of put almost a clamp on language development, language innovation. So many people flocked to it. And I think that's another example of where people have been able to just kind of adopt a technology, sit on it for decades and ride it out, and it's done well for them. But would it have succeeded like it did if Sun hadn't had such a massive investment from a marketing perspective? Who knows? Corba, kind of the same thing. Object Management Group is a group composed of, you know, hundreds of companies. All of those companies kind of pushing things like Corba and the services around it and the products that came from it. Was it good? Yeah, it was good for some things. Maybe not so good for other things. I think it really does come back to that kind of, you know, pilot program notion that I mentioned earlier. You've got to use it. You've got to try it. The marketing stuff is what it is. Of course, they're going to spin it a certain way. They're going to have examples that work well for the spin they're putting on it. But does that mean it's going to work well for you? You don't know until you absolutely, you know, sit down with it, work through it. You have to compare it against other things, whether they're popular or not. That's really the only way to get around it. You do get to the point where you start to recognize vendor kind of selling, overselling, if you want to call it that, just, you know, pushing and pushing and pushing. It does kind of wear you down and make you think, well, if it's really, you know, if they're willing to put that much time into it, it must be worth my time as well. And you tend to jump on. But at the end of the day, you just have to resist and give it a try for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's get away from products and hype-driven things. What are, in your view, some of the foundational things that people should look at? What's a sort of a prerequisite for being a good engineer?
Interesting question. I think there are technical and non-technical aspects. One thing I would say, all the kind of good engineers I can remember working with always had a curiosity. They weren't satisfied with what they had. Not in the sense that they wanted to throw everything away and start over, but in the sense of knowing that something could be improved, even a small improvement, always looking for ways to make their systems better. What goes along with that is study. You know, there's like a constant learning that has to happen. And it's, you know, some people say, well, the company should be training you and stuff like that. And I think that's a different issue. It's really about kind of your curiosity and what technical things interest you. They're not always the same as what the company who pays you are interested in, right? So finding papers, finding books, finding articles that describe certain issues, tear them down, you know, kind of come to conclusions about what works well with that approach, what doesn't, comparisons against similar approaches. Those are always good things to read for an engineer. And so I think today, you know, I mean, back when I started, I remember having to go to the library at Apollo Computer and look for papers in these big binders and stuff. And if I couldn't find it, I'd have to ask the librarian, and they'd say, well, we don't have that, but maybe I could request it from another library. And, you know, it would take days or weeks to get things. And of course, today we just search it, find it, read it. So given the technology we have today, there's really no excuse for not keeping up with things, not keeping up with your interests and your curiosity. And, you know, I know, Stefan, that you like similar music to the music I like. And, you know, you have this way of finding bands, right? You listen to a band and then you look at all the members of the band and say, who played drums? Who played bass? And you kind of go and say, do they have any solo work? Do they have work with other bands? And you find other bands or other solo artists that way. And of course, you also have music recommendation technology and stuff like that today that helps. But you can do that with papers too. You look at the authors of a paper and say, what other things did they do? And search their name and search for the topic. And you generally will find things, not only things that you know about, but things that you probably didn't know about that might even be more interesting than what you think you're interested in. So I'd say that's something that's fairly fundamental to the work we do. What else? You know, there's this thing as a non-technical issue. You have to be able to work with people. You know, if you're going to be a lone developer and kind of have your own business and write all the code yourself and do all the testing, and you know, it's doable, but very, very rarely. Generally, you have to be able to work with people, communicate with people, be able to take other people's points of view, be able to put aside your own. You know, you might have strong feelings about a particular approach or technology, but you have to kind of set that aside, listen to the counter arguments for different approaches or different technologies, and, you know, kind of separate the emotional binding that you might have to something from the technical side. And, you know, got to get along. And I think that's an important aspect as well.
So how much do you think, as an engineer, you have to look at the other surrounding aspects and disciplines than in your company or a context, like maybe the economic side of things, the business side of things, or maybe politics these days? How much do you have to be aware of those things?
Oh, that's a tough one. I think, well, it fits with what I just said in some ways. You know, that's kind of the people side of things. You have to be able to participate in that. I think looking at the business is important. You know, if I've certainly been in places where the project is cruising along and you think you're on top of the world, and all of a sudden the business decides that that's not something that they want to be involved with anymore, or they have to make cuts and that's kind of below the bar, or, you know, whatever it is. And if you're able to keep up, you know, with your own business, maybe not the entire ecosystem that your employer is in, but at least your own employer's business, keep up with what they're looking at, keep up with their direction, those kinds of things will be less likely to bite you. At the flip side, if you're working on something that's, you know, very, very important to the business, it's good to know that as well, and have some kind of contact with customers, knowing what customers want, being able to provide what they want. That's critical, of course, because if you're just developing stuff that you want, it may not be what the customer wants and might drive the system in a direction that's undesirable. In terms of politics, a lot of companies do have a lot of internal politics, that's for sure. And I've generally found it's better to stay out of those, because you tend to wind up either in a place you don't want to be or getting burned somehow. So it's sometimes hard to stay out of, because if you feel strongly about a particular direction or a particular product, you want to jump in the fray and defend it and help, you know, push it, you're going to get involved in politics. That's just human nature. It's where there are people, there's politics. But you know, it comes back to being honest, being open, trying to, again, be open to evaluating different ideas, different approaches, different viewpoints. I think that helps not only you, but it helps the people around you see that you're a person to be respected and a person who's thoughtful enough to have considered, you know, many viewpoints. And, you know, I think that gets you to a position where people start to seek your advice, and then you do have more influence than you might otherwise. You know, if you're always shutting down others' ideas or just ignoring them or saying my way is the only way, then that's going to bite you too. You're going to get isolated, and you're going to find that you have less influence than you might otherwise wish or might otherwise have.
Hmm. Have you ever been in an ethical dilemma? And if so, what's your advice on those kinds of things where you're maybe somebody wants you to do something that you really, really feel bad about?
Yes. For me, and I know this is important to you as well, software patents. I've worked in a number of places that have patented software. I've been pushed because in the past I've been a technical vice president. I've been a chief architect, senior architect. You know, when you're in those positions, this idea of patenting does come along. You know, people want to protect the company's assets and IP and everything. So you get in this situation where you're kind of forced to look at the technologies you have and see if there's anything patentable. And I fundamentally don't believe in software patents. So it's kind of like, well, what do I do? So in those cases, I either, if I could, I would decline to participate and just say this isn't, I don't believe in this and I don't think it's right. And I've managed to do that a few times. In other cases, I was still kind of asked to put together a list of things that might be patentable, and then they would just go find somebody else to evaluate them. I knew of one case where there was some technology where I knew of prior art, and I showed the lawyers the prior art written in published papers, and they just said, oh, that doesn't matter, we could still get a patent, and somehow they did. Right. Mm-hmm. So in that case, I felt like I did kind of everything I could to do the right thing, but the wrong thing still happened. Mm-hmm. I think you just have to kind of stick to what you know to be right. And sometimes I've even looked at the ethics that have been written up by groups like the ACM or the IEEE. I'm a member of both of those groups, and I've actually at times gone through and read through those things where I was stuck in some ethical dilemma, and I find them helpful. You know, they do provide general guidance. You might also, you know, find a more experienced person than yourself and ask for their advice if you're kind of stuck in those situations. Hopefully not too many people get stuck in those though.
Okay. So let's get a bit back to the mentoring thing of the career path. Something that people might ask is it a good idea to stick to coding throughout your career, or should you try to transcend that as early as possible and do something else, whatever that is, architecture or management or something that may not be as much related as coding as when you start out?
Well, I've always wanted to be coding, and I still do. I've found that even those times when I had those lofty positions of technical VP or chief architect, I was not effective unless I was coding at the same time. The reason for that is at the end of the day, the code is the truth. It's what the system is. It defines everything the system does. And you can have all the kind of diagrams about what the system is, or slides, or white papers, or whatever, that somehow are alternative descriptions of the system, but the code is what the system is. So if you don't know the code, then you don't truly know the system. I'd say for me, it kind of boils down to two choices. You're either going to stay on the technical side or move into management. Some people like managing people. There's lots of challenges with that, and that's certainly if you're good at that, that's to be commended. And if that interests you, then yeah, you should go that way. You should also know that if you think you're going to be a people manager and also write lots of code, it's probably not going to happen. I know of people who have done it, and I can count them on one hand, literally, over all these years. So it's kind of rare. So if you don't want to be a manager, then yes, keep coding. Always keep coding. And that's what I've done.
Okay. You've worked at a number of different companies in your career. What was the most fun? Was it small companies or big companies? Was it while you were maybe in consulting or product development or doing project work? Was it maintenance or greenfield development? Or what were the most interesting times in your career?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I think the most fun times I've had is just working with people that I like being around, people with certain talents in the technical arena, but also, you know, they're interesting people as well. I've been fortunate to have met quite a few characters along the way and have had some very good times. I've met very, very few people that I wish I hadn't met, like fewer than five, I would say. So that's been good. I think to try to isolate it down to like greenfield versus maintenance or small versus big, I don't enjoy big companies. So Apollo had a few thousand people, and then HP bought them. And of course, HP then was pretty big and just kept getting bigger and bigger. HP back then, that was like 28 years ago or something. Back then, they were still on top of things. Dave and Bill were still around and had influence on the company. And the thing that made HP great was still part of HP, the HP way. You've probably heard of that. So It was an interesting place to work as a big company. But then that started to wane and fade away. And it became this kind of, I don't know, it was like a collection of smaller companies all competing with each other within a big company. It was hard to get anything done. And you saw these kind of middle managers trying to build empires and battling with each other as if they were separate companies, competing with each other. That got to be a drag. So once I left there, I just said, I don't think I'll ever go back to a big company. And never did. I think working at smaller companies is better. You get to know the people who are there. You get to have better visibility, not only into the system you're building or systems you're building, but who works on what. What their strengths are, how they can be applied, different people can apply their talents to different areas. You get to kind of see the business side as well, maybe be directly in touch with customers, be on sales calls, be on support calls, where the customer is quite angry with you and you have to figure out what the problem is and fix it. That's always a good thing to experience, as painful as it might be. So I tend to like companies where you have the ability to see across the business, not only engineering, but business as well. In terms of new development versus maintenance, this might sound crazy, but I think it takes a better engineer to be a maintenance developer than it does to be someone cranking out new code.
Mm-hmm. How so?
I think when you have something that's there in front of you, it has a certain structure. You have to be able to kind of respect that structure and fit whatever it is you're doing into that structure. Now, sure, you could change the structure and maybe you tweak it a bit, but you're kind of like taking something that's working and leaving it in a better place. When you have new development, you're kind of just, I think you're cranking stuff out and it's got a lot of holes in it. And you might think it's like the best thing you ever wrote, but it's going to have holes in it. It's going to have bugs in it. It's going to have sometimes holes big enough to drive trains through or whatever. And you're going to be kind of oblivious to it. What really, the mentality I really don't like kind of related to that is I'm going to write all this new code and then it's going to be someone else's problem to fix. That's very bad. Don't do that. The companies that I've worked for that have been the most successful in terms of what they've produced and in terms of keeping people there and keeping people interested in what they're doing are companies where engineers develop code and they maintain that code. They write tests for that code. And that doesn't mean you can't move on to different things, that you're always stuck with your own code and the, you know, that everything you've written in the past. That's not true. What I'm really talking about is kind of a life cycle and, you know, write it, test it, maintain it, fix it. And fortunately today that the notion of continuous integration, continuous development is fairly widespread. And I think that that approach uses this kind of life cycle thing I'm talking about. So it's not foreign to a lot of developers today, which is good, but it's certainly something I've seen in the past that is to be avoided. But I'd say most of what developers work on, the majority tends to be more maintenance related than new code development. That's why it's good to be strong in that area.
Okay. So from the mentoring side of things, as well as from imagining you're just a regular coworker, how do you deal with that young, talented, ambitious, but still pretty clueless colleague who just doesn't know that he or she doesn't know everything? On the contrary, they actually believe they do know everything. How do you actually help them to appreciate things and actually become better at their job?
Well, I'd say one thing that we try to do, you know, like where I currently work, we have a way of hiring that I think doesn't always bring in people that are so blind to themselves, shall we say. So that's good. So we do get people who kind of have that curiosity I mentioned earlier, that aren't afraid to work on fixing bugs instead of writing new code, that kind of have a more rounded approach to things. So I think I'm fortunate in that regard. That doesn't mean that they don't need mentoring and they can't learn or anything like that. That's definitely not true. And I'd say that's definitely not true of anybody. But I think the main approach is to really focus on that whole notion of life cycle. You know, if they write some bug fix, review it, you know, take a look at it. Where I work now, all code is reviewed. You know, goes up in a browser and you can look at it and you can comment on individual lines, just like things you can do at GitHub, very similar to that. You can put comments in, you can raise issues, you can, you know, actually block the thing from getting merged if it came to that. Fortunately, it doesn't really ever come to that. But the main thing is to kind of ask questions about, you know, you did this, but have you considered the following issues? And it requires you as a mentor to have kind of a bigger picture in mind. They might be thinking of, you know, the very particular fix they're putting in or the very particular change they're putting in, but they're going to be effects of whatever it is they're doing. you know, maybe they changed the API to some class or something, and it might affect systems in other areas that they didn't know existed. So you have to be able to point things like that out. They might be using the language, programming language, in a certain way that isn't idiomatic, that maybe there are better ways of doing it that are more normally done with that language. You know, so things like that have to be pointed out. You have to evaluate the change to make sure that it's doing what the customer needs it to do, that it fits with the architecture, that there isn't some code that already does what they've done that they could have just reused. You know, all that kind of stuff is the job of a mentor. And you have to do it in a way that, you know, isn't kind of squashing that person's notion of contribution, right? Like if they put something in and they're kind of happy with it, you have to kind of gently ask questions like, did you consider this? Or, hey, have you seen this part? Oh, you know, your code reminds me. I've totally forgot. There's this piece over here that we could reuse. Did you look at that? Right. And kind of think of the human side of the equation. You have a person there who's doing their best, and you want to keep them doing their best. And, you know, be gentle. Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's the job of the mentor to have kind of that bigger picture in mind and be able to get that picture across to the person they're mentoring.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's turn this around and say you're the new person, maybe not directly from college or university, but maybe you have a few years of experience, but there's this wise, experienced person, well-known, possibly even with lots of experience, and they're really smart, but they're also completely disillusioned and stubborn in their own ways. How do you go about changing a person's mind if they're like that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I remember once when I was a very young developer at Apollo, I was working on a boot ROM for some system. So you had to, like, you had your code and you had to, like, burn that onto a double EEPROM, and then you'd plug it in and hope that it booted the system. And if it didn't, well, back to the drawing board and figure it out. And because of my kind of lack of, formal software training or whatever, I was kind of struck one day by this notion of that thing that burned the PROM, you know, this machine, you'd load your code into it and it would write it all into the ROM. And I was like, I wonder how this actually works inside. And I asked somebody, and they said, oh, you should go ask this one particular kind of senior developer. And I remember that guy had, they all had offices back then with doors and everything. This guy had like several bookcases arranged around the door of his office. So once you went in the door, you had to navigate through this maze of bookcases to even find the guy. That was a signal. Like, don't bother me. But being young and naive, I navigated through and asked, hey, how does this thing work? And you could also smoke in your offices back then. And he was smoking the cigarette, and he actually just stopped. He's staring at his screen, stopped and turned and looked at me and, like, just told me to get the hell out of his office. Like, didn't ever answer the question. Don't be like that. You know, that's if you're the kind of person that you described in your question, at least don't take it that far. Yeah, I never did get the answer to that question. But I'd say the thing about when you have experienced people, you do have to respect the fact that they know things. They didn't get to where they are by not knowing things. They have strengths, and you kind of have to figure out what those strengths are and start to pick up on the things that are important to them. Why are those things important? I think if you were to ask somebody I've noticed that you prefer this way of doing this particular thing. Why is that? You know, is there something hidden in there? Is it just based on experience that that works out best? You know, what are the alternatives? Why aren't they as good? Most people will tend to sit back and say, well, here's why. And you gain some insight into their thinking. And I think you can then, you know, start almost, it's almost like you're joining their team, right? That you start to see why they do certain things a certain way. And if you're kind of showing them that you understand why things are the way they are, once you have that understanding and they see that you have it, it's a lot easier to change their mind about things, because then they know that you have studied the system, you know it's why it's done the way it is, but here's some alternatives that you think they might want to look at. The alternative, of course, is to kind of charge in and say, well, that's the past, here's the future, or here's why this has to be done, and you're sort of setting yourself up for this battle that you probably don't want. So it's just better, I'd say, to take time and at least get to understand the system and the person or people behind it, why they do certain things a certain way, and you'll have a better time influencing that system afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One of the things that you did throughout your career, I think, was to write a lot of papers and magazine articles and do a lot of conference presentations. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many. Did you keep track of how many of those you did, actually?
No. In terms of articles, I know there were over 100.
Yeah.
Not greatly over 100, but over 100. Conference presentations, I would say hundreds.
Mm-hmm. So is that something that you recommend doing? And would you advise people to consider doing that? Or under what circumstances would you suggest that people do that?
That's a tough one as well. I think the reason I got into it was because of, you know, I mentioned early on in this podcast the notion of being curious and looking for approaches that might solve problems you're working on, reading papers. I was doing that. I was reading books. I was reading papers and kind of voraciously, you know, just absorbing and absorbing. And some of the authors of those papers I contacted, and I would get to know them. And they were the ones who started encouraging me to publish my own articles or write my own books or whatever it was. And it's not an easy thing to do, or give conference talks or whatever. It's certainly not an easy thing to do, because it takes quite a bit of time. I was lucky in that I had, my wife was very supportive of my work, even if it meant kind of spending night times working on papers or books or whatever, or traveling to conferences. My employers generally were supportive of that as well, taking time off to go give a talk. So I understand that some people don't necessarily have that opportunity, and that makes it difficult. So that's something you have to be aware of, is that it's going to impact your work and your personal life. And if you're lucky enough to have a system around you that does support it, then I definitely recommend it. It's going to open your eyes to a lot of things, a lot of work of other people. It's going to kind of make you think about things that you thought were just kind of hard truths, all of a sudden are revealed not to be when you see some of the work of other people. Or even, you know, you get like a question at a talk, you know, someone asks a question about the talk you just gave, and you might think, oh, that's interesting, and go off and kind of research their question and find like this whole door opens to another world that you were unaware of. So if you're that curious type of person and you do have that support system that allows you to do this, then publishing and speaking are definitely good things to do.
Okay. So, did we cover most of what we wanted to cover? Is there something that you want to add, a piece of advice for the young engineer?
Yeah, there's, I kind of hinted at it earlier, but don't wrap yourself up emotionally in what you're working on. It's not always the easiest thing to do. You do, you know, once you spend a lot of time on something, it becomes like a, you know, it's your work and you want to protect it. But, you know, everything we do changes so much, changes so rapidly that you just can't get attached. There's business behind this. You know, it's not just a pure coding exercise. Most of the time there's business choices that have to be made. And sometimes they are made in a way that isn't favorable to your technical choices. So try to avoid not only emotionally wrapping yourself up with what you work on, but don't be that technology. You know, for a while, I was the Corba guy. Then I became the REST guy. Then I was the Erlang guy. And then I don't know what I am now. Just the old guy, I think. But, you know, that's good that, you know, if you become that sort of person where you're identified with a particular technology, that's fine. But don't just hang out there forever. Reinvent yourself. Look at the alternatives and say, you know, we did that work. It was good for what it was, but here's a different way now. And kind of don't be afraid to take that next step.
Very good. Okay. So, Steve, thanks for all the advice and all the wise words. I really, really enjoyed the conversation. We'll put in a bunch of links into the show notes to your other work. Is there anything that we should add related to mentoring? Any book you can recommend or resource you can recommend on this particular topic?
Well, not really. I mean, I don't tend to look to books for the mentoring side of things. I think it's just more, you know, the feel that I have for having done this for so long and what people need to know and that sort of thing. I do recommend that developers become familiar with the innovator's dilemma and not just the word disruption, because that's overused now, but the actual science behind it. And, you know, it will help you see things in a way that helps guide what you do on a daily basis. So there's that. But just in terms of mentoring, I think it, you know, don't forget it's people. You know, it comes down to people. You're on a team, you're working with people, you have to be someone who people want to work with, and, you know, conduct yourself in a way that would make you somebody that people do want to help and be around. The only other thing I would want to say is, if people want, you know, hear this podcast and they have questions or whatever, they can certainly email me. My address is my last name at IEEE.org. Email me and I'm sure to answer you.
Excellent. Okay. Thanks again, Steve, for the very inspiring conversation.
Thanks for having me.